Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine and I'm now joined by Alex Stewart.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you? And Seb Stafford-Blore.
Hello, Joe Devine.
How's things?
It's good. You were humming the Rocky theme tune, so I'm ready to go. I'm pumped up.
That's good.
Yeah.
I can see you, Sly
Fire
Stallone.
In my eyes. Yeah,
sure.
Absolutely.
Full of beef and muscle.
Verve.
Ready to talk about the football.
Yes.
Football. And let's smash today's football out of the park, a bit like what The Athletic do on a daily basis. That's theathletic.com/TIFO, theathletic.com/TIFO, for all of the greatest football writing available. For a small fee. And guess what? That
deal.
Fee got smaller this week because of a deal. Do you know what the deal is, Alex?
I don't.
Do you know what the deal is, Seb?
I do.
Well, good. No, I don't want to hear what it is. I just wanted to know which of you was paying attention, and it's just you.
I'm too busy paying attention to the premium quality content.
Well, there you go. The thing is, Alex thinks it's so good that he doesn't even think about how much it costs him. It's free, he's staff. But for you non-staff people, you can get The Athletic this week for £1 per month for 6 months. And if you do the maths there, Alex.
Yeah.
That's £6 for 6 months. Think
yes,
of all the other things that you might spend £6 on, yeah? An Uber to go from your house to another nearby house. Or two coffees. Or £6.
I spent £4 on a Pret A Manger soup the other day.
Right.
That's
a waste of money.
Compared to the Athletic, that is horrendous value.
That's bad value.
It's like one and a half Sunday newspapers, which is not a lot.
Or if you buy any kind of skin cream, but you buy a large pot of it.
A tub, probably.
A larger than usual tub from a Super Boots or something.
Yeah.
Maybe about £6.
Yeah. Moisturizing is really important.
Yeah, it sure is.
Yeah. Theathletic.com/TIFO. And that is one of the best deals you'll get all year. So if you're not already subscribed, now would be the time to do so. Check it out. The Athletic. Anyway, on today's list of topics to discuss, the Manchester Derby happened, of course. Watford and Arsenal was an interesting game that occurred. Leicester, Leeds, Liverpool, West Ham. I'm just listing football teams now. Other things happened which we will come to discuss as well. It's a jam-packed Monday show, and it's full of jam. So,
get some toast.
Get some toast.
Butter
you, the audience can be our bread and we'll spread ourselves across them.
Well, some
to
of
make
them.
A jam bread. This hasn't gone very well, this intro.
Manchester Derby.
Yeah, well, do you remember first we do the intro
yeah, but
music?
I feel like,
and
yeah,
then,
but there was the really long... It's because your segue into the Athletic promo was way too clean
I
and
was
professional.
Too
you know how I hate the uncomfortable silences and I can't just languish in them like you do.
So you know what I hate? Yeah. Self-indulgent like deliberation on things that have already happened. No one likes this bit. No one listens to it, you know, but you're forcing it to happen.
They have to tolerate it because that's the nature of the podcast.
I will leave you now on the warm hands and the cool embrace of the bit of the podcast that people in the comments are going to say, I wish they didn't do this bit. It was better when they just talked about football. You know, that bit. Manchester City 4. One Manchester United. Interesting game, Seb. Interesting game. To be honest, I thought Manchester United started the game quite well. I thought it was easy to see elements or aspects of improvement under Ralf Rangnick. It was also, I mean, I think those elements did highlight the areas that haven't improved quite starkly in the second half.
Yeah, so interesting behind the curtain for me. I watched the first half live. And like you, I thought, okay, this is decent. City are still winning. City are better.
Sure.
The City do have better players and are coached better. And
yeah.
So, you know, but it still felt like a par of a performance. Then I traveled to London and watched the second half. And the second half felt like a parody of all of Man United's flaws in a way. It was ugly. And it turned what was actually only their second Premier League defeat of 2022. Which,
right.
Surprised me
was
because
it?
There's so much negativity. But then that amount of negativity is kind of it's an indication of just how rotten a 45 minutes it was and how, I think the word I'd use, how helpless United looked, which is, I know all things about United lead back to how much they spent on assembling the squad, but It looked like the kind of performance Everton might give against Manchester City, sort of unable to compete. Please don't hurt me.
What changed in the second half, Alex? Because as we said, we thought they were all right in the first half.
Yeah, I think the pressing structures in the first half were reasonable, but also indicated how they would get bypassed.
Right.
So the press wasn't as cohesive as it should have been. I think the other problem was that particularly the ability of De Bruyne and Foden, De Bruyne pushing up and Foden dropping back to find that space in between the lines, particularly around what they call zone 14, the sort of top of the box area, which is where most creative activity should occur. United didn't adjust to that. And as United got more frustrated and more tired and the individual errors crept in, City just kept doing what they were doing. So although the first half was reasonable, it clearly indicated that if United didn't adjust, which they didn't,
sure,
City would just ramp up the pressure and then make it very easy for themselves.
So can I dig down on that a little bit? Because they played the 4-2-2-2 formation, which is something that we haven't seen them do for a while. Just to sort of set the foundation for this game, I was particularly interested to see them against a big team because Ralf Rangnick is known for his ability to not necessarily just to counterattack, but to press big possession teams quite well, knows how to play in those sorts of games. And so it was interesting, of course, to see their results against smaller teams, but I was looking forward to a game like this to see if they would suddenly look like a good team. The things that they were doing in the first half that indicated what might happen in the second half, why were they happening? Are they just a team that are not yet used to playing in the Rangnick style, or are they a team that have too many individual errors with the players?
I think both is a reasonable thing to say. I mean, the issue that there's that funny little Paul Merson bit from a Saturday football thing where he's talking about Maguire and his ability to defend space in front of him. And he's like, you know, he's good at Leicester because he sits back and he defends the box. And if you're going to press, you need defenders that are not afraid to be isolated one-on-one. One of the reasons that Liverpool can press so high or City can press so high is because in their centre-backs, they have sufficient individual quality to dominate one-on-one battles and to cover space. And United don't have that. So Lindelof will get dragged too far forwards, like when Foden flicked the ball over him. Maguire will kind of want to go forwards, but not back himself in terms of his pace or agility. And so if you start leaving those holes at the back, you're then going to get spacing problems through the midfield. And I thought where United look best is when they were pressing City higher up the pitch. Mm. So Alanga worked really, really hard. Sancho's quite a good presser from his time at Dortmund. And if they compact that space and press high, they look okay.
Yeah.
But they then have a tendency to overcommit in an individual press, and all of a sudden the spacing problems throughout the rest of the team get exposed and City can just play straight through them.
Interesting to see what you think of this, Alex, because to me, when I watch United in that kind of situation, when they're against an elite opponent, you really notice the lack of, I don't know if I call it intelligence, but lack of instinct around their pressing. So it was a game, I think it was the Liverpool game at Old Trafford. We did a video about it. We did, it was all about sort of cover shadows and how Man United players had developed this tendency of just running at the ball without really thinking about what they're cutting off.
This was one of Solskjaer's last games, right?
Exactly that, just before Solskjaer left. And when part of the press at United is bypassed, or when a player is moved out of position by his own free will or because he's covering for somebody else, nobody shuffles into the space particularly well. It doesn't occur to anybody that's what you need to do. And the Liverpool point is really interesting because you have those two fullbacks or wingbacks sometimes, who are always often caught high up the pitch and are given a license to do things. But then that's because Virgil van Dijk and more recently Konate, they understand where the space is that they need to cover. And for United, it just seems that basic bit of footballing intelligence is just absent. And everything is Harry Maguire's done that. He stepped out of the defence. Therefore, me, Victor Lindelof, I need to go hit. It's mechanical. It's not a natural sort of, I don't know what the, it doesn't shuffle properly.
I think the only player that they have who shuffles is Fred.
Yeah, yeah.
I think Fred's actually really good at that.
He's weirdly not been playing as much as he was before. I mean, Pogba's returned from injury, which will be one of the reasons why. But I've thought consistently under Rangnick, Fred's looked like not the best player, but the player who's most adapted to the new coach.
Yeah, he's most involved in the most things.
He's so sprightly. This game at times as well.
Well, he was very unlucky not to score. I mean, that was a really smart piece of goalkeeping from Edison, which I don't think got enough credit at the time. But when you press, you have to... this is something that we'll probably come on to talk about when we talk about Leeds, but the way that the rest of the team orientates in order to facilitate that press is incredibly important. And United just seem to have this issue where their shape looks reasonable up until the point they really commit to a press, and then suddenly it looks weirdly ragged. I mean, I agree. Like, Maguire gets exposed. I mean, so for the first goal, what Wan-Bissaka is doing by either not going out to close a man or not dropping off to defend the space, but sort of standing halfway between the two things. Like, that's the kind of thing. Maguire then looks really flat-footed and clumsy as a result of that. But it's not his fault. Like, sure, he's horribly exposed.
He should never be in
that
position because fundamentally, he lacks the body shape to defend like that. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have the mobility to be... He's not Virgil van Dijk. Like, you cannot leave him in a one-on-one and expect good things to happen afterwards. So it's kind of a systemic failure to me.
Someone on Twitter described it as looking like a bear chasing a kite when he was...
A plastic bag in a hurricane.
But again, he had the same problems with, you know, even against Southampton, I think it was Brozier, like, made him look really quite silly a few times. Yeah. And this is the point. When you're scouting a centre-back, particularly when you're going to drop all of that money on, you can't just look at, you know, percentage of aerials won, percentage of progressive passes completed or whatever. You have to assess those kinds of defenders in the context of the systems in which they play. You can't simply pick up a good defender in a system. And this is... You know, when you go back to Ruben Diaz, who I wasn't massively sold on when he moved to Man City because he didn't defend particularly well one-on-one, but because City's system compensates for that, he looks exceptionally good. Yeah. I got that wrong.
It emphasizes his strengths.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, but you also need to know what you're bad at, don't you? Like, when you sign a player, you need to know, okay, so the signing represents probably what you want to become. And the kind of, you know, the status of player that is going to take you to the level of the game that you want to occupy also needs to defer to what is already at the club. So if you buy a player that struggles in isolation and you have a defence which is full of weaknesses and weak points, it can be very, very difficult for that player to ever realise his proper value in that team.
But this is the problem with United ultimately. And obviously there's lots of conversations around whether Rangnick is like the right interim coach, having had this role at Lokomotiv Moscow and, you know, not being coaching in the dugout for quite some time, blah, 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 Solskjaer, odd appointment, blah, blah, blah. But it stems back to really squad building. There has been no consistent approach to squad building. There's no thoughtfulness in terms of how these players are acquired, why they're acquired. The biggest single one, obviously, is the Ronaldo signing.
Yeah.
But even then...
I think the thought is in... the value of the player commercially.
Which is an incredibly dumb way to run a football club.
Well, let's talk about that. I just want to mention something else on the defenders too, before we move on, because we talk about the things that maybe Lindelof and Maguire aren't best suited to as part of the system. Things you would expect them to be well suited to, they did poorly in this game. There were instances with both defenders. With Maguire, it was De Bruyne shrugged him off the ball. With Lindelof, it was Foden that shrugged him off the ball and made them both look like, you know...
Wan-Bissaka as well, obviously, the famous moment.
Yeah.
That is the perfect negative moment for a modern player, isn't it? Because what it describes isn't really important. How it looks and what it seems to suggest is just perfect for the social media age because it's just, you know...
Talking about it.
Well, yeah, but you can also imagine in 5 years' time, like, you know, having a bad day at work, something bad happening to you in your personal life and someone using that as a meme.
Sure.
You know, and that's a terrible thing to happen to a younger player, particularly one who's kind of suffered under the weight of a £50 million transfer fee, but it still shouldn't happen.
Is it a bit like that time that you said that France won the Euros when it was Portugal that did?
Yeah, and we had to...
Illustrator Phil had to
correct me, yeah.
But you're actually the... sort of and lead editorial kind of like, layer. You're the guy with all the knowledge.
Exactly that. And that's like, I'm being Phil Fodened by Phil Fenner.
Sure.
And I'm Aaron Wan-Bissaka. I do. I think second. I'm just being shrugged off the ball. Yeah. And not only that, I don't even remain in the frame. I've just been shrugged off the ball so yeah. forcefully that I just skittle out of the shot.
I think people probably underestimate the physicality of yeah. small. I mean, De Bruyne no, sure. is kind of a tank, actually, yeah. and plays as a box to box, and mm. you know, he can do things that make you assume that he's crafty and wispy yeah, yeah, and yeah. all the rest of it, but he's not.
Let me ask you this. Would you prefer to be body checked by a smaller man? You know, but the contact area is like the full torso, or would you prefer to be jabbed in the ribs with two fingers? Which do you think would hurt more? The rib jabbing.
The rib jabbing.
Therefore,
would hurt
the
more.
Smaller the man, the more it hurts to bounce off them.
If he's smaller than you, Mike,
know?
he might sort of get up underneath your rib cage, yeah. and that could be quite, you know.
What if he, you know?
I prefer to take the shoulder to shoulder challenge.
I prefer that.
Yeah.
Well, you understand what I'm saying, right? The smaller the point of contact, the more pain.
There's that thing, isn't there, about how a woman wearing a high heel exerts more pressure on the floor
yeah,
than an elephant
surface area
because
and all the forces oh, no, directed
the,
into one
the physics is yeah, yeah.
wow
but it's it exemplifies
well,
your point.
Education
yeah great
should we say that in Latin?
They didn't even teach us science in my school, obviously. I don't even know what that is.
What science?
They did
science?
It was just all one lesson. Yeah, you just went in and it was
called
school.
Science.
It was
yeah.
just school.
It was just school. Sure. Sure. We've had this conversation a couple of times. I think it's sort of it's worth returning to after this fixture. Rangnick, the kind of pervasive theory now is that it was it's either a bad idea because if he doesn't do well, they're not going to want to keep him as a you know as a backroom staff member, or it was a bad idea because if he does do well, they'll want to keep him and he's not staying. So. What do we think now? I mean, are we at the stage where, do you see enough Serb improvements in that game despite the second half, despite the result, to suggest that Ralf Rangnick is having a positive impact on Manchester United and that, you know, the time will bear out the wisdom of that choice or no? Would you be worried?
Well, I've seen enough to suggest that if over time Man United's transfer policy was built around what Ralf Rangnick wants at the club, it could be successful. But that's just never going to happen at Man United because what Rangnick wants and what United do are two very different things.
Sure.
And so what you've done is you've married a very headstrong, uncompromising head coach who's actually really not really a head coach anymore. He is an architect.
Sure.
In the kind of the macro sense, with a club who have basically created a very decadent comfort zone for underperforming first team players, and you could not possibly have come up with a worse combination of things. So I don't see how this works because it involves either Rangnick changing his ways so dramatically that he becomes an appeaser, or Manchester United allowing themselves to, well,
not,
basically
not be
performing a huge ideological shift. Yeah, exactly. And neither of those things is going to happen.
Well, here's a different question for you, Alex. I had this conversation with friend of the podcast, John McKenzie, the other day. We were talking about Ralf Rangnick.
He is a friend of the podcast. We like him.
Yeah, that's why I called him that, yeah. That's a weird interruption.
The most emphatic I think I've ever seen. So he is.
Yeah, John, I think Seb really likes you.
Yeah, we do like John.
Sure. Or, no, I know. Why are you saying it like it's defensive?
Well, I think maybe he's assuming that you're being sarcastic or
no,
something.
No, I'm being serious. Okay. Yeah.
No, John's,
I play Rocket League with John. Anyway, yeah.
I was neutralizing your sarcasm.
Should we take a quick vote? Do we like John? Yes. Everyone likes John. Let's move on. Fine. The conversation I had with John was about what Ralf Rangnick did at the Red Bull conglomerate, you know,
sure.
as well as previously. It's my contention that what he is so good at, or has been so good at in the past, is creating a team where the sort of overall unit is more effective than the sum of its parts. Let's say, like, or brings more value to the forward than you would have thought. Then again, if you look at sort of what most big teams do these days, or by big I mean teams that either have lots of money or want to be dominating leagues, they play with a lot more possession, right? The expectations of how teams are going to play against them are slightly different than they might have been in many cases with the Red Bull model or with his previous clubs. And also the level of players that they can attract being the key thing is different, right? Like, one of the reasons, is it fair to say, that RB Leipzig work well as a team is because despite the fact that they can't just go out and buy Jadon Sancho, they buy players that are maybe undervalued elsewhere or aren't as well known, but they turn those players into cogs within a working machine. That is enabled by the fact that because those players are lesser known or perhaps are undervalued, the ego doesn't come along with it. Now, I'm not saying ego with a big player is a bad thing. I think if you're one of the best football players in the world and you're earning £200,000 a week, you should have an ego. And if you don't like what your coach is telling you, I think that's also okay, right? I don't subscribe to the idea that every player, regardless of how good they are, needs to listen to exactly what some old person is telling them. No, they shouldn't be submissive. They should be active within the relationship. When you're at Manchester United, and you don't agree with that, fine, Alex, that's fine. But when you're at Manchester United as a coach and you have all of these players underneath you, all of whom were brought in for significant sums over, you know, different regimes, came for different sorts of things, but they're all there because they want to win trophies. I don't think you can manage that team in the same way that you can manage RB Leipzig. And I wonder whether Ralf Rangnick's model or approach to football doesn't work if you are expected to be on top. It only works if you're expected to be an underdog. Now, maybe that's a gross misunderstanding.
No.
But what do you think?
No, I think that's right. I think the couple of key points for that is that even as Leipzig started to become the best of the rest in Germany, which they clearly are, and obviously the appointment of Nagelsmann was part of that, their transfer policy did not alter a great deal. No. So they were still looking for, exactly as you're describing, the unproven talents. That's why they scout West Africa particularly heavily, for example. It's why they look at, you know,
Scandinavia
and they have the thing with Salzburg. Currently, one of their best players in Cuckoo was a pickup from PSG's academy, where he wasn't apparently making the grade, and he's now one of the most exciting attackers in European football. Yeah. So there is definitely a thing there. And I think the fact that because they are part of the network, the Red Bull network, they're never going to be as liked, right? So they don't have to worry about themselves summiting and being popular and being media friendly in the same kind of way. They don't have to go out and chase the big star for the social media thing, because no one's going to like them anyway. Sure. Like, they don't really care. So they can take pride in the way their model works, in how they overperform on the pitch. I think it's interesting that from a tactical perspective, Nagelsmann's last season, they did start to try to dominate games more in terms of possession and play with less verticality.
Yeah, as we've seen with Klopp at Liverpool, right?
Right, exactly this. But Klopp has nurtured that process over a longer period of time, and he has made incremental changes to the squad in a way that allows him to do that. I think it comes back to basically what, I mean, I agree with everything that you've said, and I think it comes back to what Seb said before, which is that
we all like John McKenzie.
We all like John McKenzie. But also, if you're appointing someone like Rangnick, you have to allow him to create everything that works within the club structurally. And his model of how that should be done, I mean, he's a clever enough man to be able to alter it so that it does account for the possibility of buying bigger players and spending more money and having other factors affect why you might sign someone. But also, his style of football is still a bit punch up. And United are caught between feeling that they always are punching down in spite of the fact that their recent results show no such indication. And also, I think enough understanding that the way things have been done hasn't worked. But which of those is going to win out? It's always going to be the, we're Manchester United. We don't have to do this kind of thing. They should just, the sensible thing for them to do, not in terms of actually winning stuff, but in terms of feeling more comfortable in their own skin, is to appoint a superstar manager, go and spend a shitload of money on players and see what happens.
Well, like and this was part of the conversation with John.
They're never going to be clever. That's
what
the
about,
problem.
I agree with that. And let's look at Real Madrid under Zidane, who won three Champions Leagues in a row and did it without a sniff of a philosophy, to call it that, right? Zidane very clearly knew how to manage those players. He knew how to best keep the dressing room happy, the morale high. It probably is helped by the fact that he was one of the best players in the world and they will have all grown up watching him, so they all respect him. He's a superstar in his own right. And that they had all better players than the other teams that they played against. Mm. You can see an example from you know, as Seb said at the very beginning of this podcast, Manchester City was still winning in the first half, despite the fact that United played well, because they've got better players and they're a better team and they're better coach, whatever, right? I do wonder if that's the thing to do. I know that, you know, there have been rumours about United talking about Zidane before. I don't know whether that's true or not. The general response to that is dismay. And I wonder if maybe it's the right thing to do.
Well, I think there's two things to say. The first thing to say is that United's dressing room is still too much of a mess for that to work at this point in time.
Yeah.
So they'd need to go and buy their Sergio Ramos and their Casemiro to build stuff on.
Yeah.
But I think the thing with football tactics, right, the stuff that, you know, when we talk about the tactics that are exciting, they are often developed as a way of compensating for not having better players, right? So even when Jurgen Klopp was coming up with the way that he created this kind of frenetic heavy metal football in Dortmund, and even previous, well, Mainz was a different thing, but at Dortmund it was because he was never going to beat Bayern Munich otherwise, right? Even with really good players like Lewandowski and Reus and so on. As he's become more established and had more money to spend, he's adapted his tactics, right? He doesn't need to do as much of that all of the time to win. Pep is a bit of a weird outlier because he's this sort of perfectionist who is constantly seeking to innovate almost for its own sake sometimes, it seems, and that's just how he gets his kicks. And I like that because it produces great football. But almost everybody else is developing clever systems because they can't go out and buy a midfield of Toni Kroos and Luka Modric and Casemiro, right?
Sure.
So once you have to pick one or the other, you have a manager like a Zidane or an Ancelotti who is like all vibes and assembles a great squad, keeps them harmonious, gets them playing nice football because fuck, they're really gifted and technical, and so they're going to win games.
The organic process unroll.
And players like him. Sure. Exactly. This is really important.
I've always thought, and it's a little bit of a simplification, but I always worry of appointing a manager who his personality traits or his attitude towards the game is at odds with where a club is at any given moment. So if you appoint someone who is typically has a chip on their shoulder to lead Manchester United, bad things are going to happen.
Sure.
I don't think it's a coincidence that Manchester United's most healthy period in terms of it being quite harmonious and for a long time going well was when you had Solskjaer there, and Solskjaer clearly had his flaws, but he was a deference to the previous era, and that worked because it suited the internal mindset.
And players liked him.
Players liked him. Similarly, Klopp worked at Liverpool because he's a brilliant manager. He's a fabulous tactician. He gets on very, very well with players. He inspires great performances. But also, he was your kind of rage against the system coach for a Liverpool team who had not won the Premier League for a really long time and who had a bit of a chip on their shoulder. Pochettino at Spurs. Pochettino making his name. Pochettino not taken seriously by the elite clubs in the world in world football. Spurs weren't, still aren't. And so the marriage, sadly, the marriage was perfect because they were both aimed towards the same thing. You put Ranić at Man United, you have someone, as Alex has said, who is used to being hated, who is used to being an underdog, who's used to being at a club where you're not expected to achieve things and everything is a little bit of a, you know, a jab in the face for the orthodoxy.
Sure.
And you put him at the ultimate aristocrat in the game.
I was just going to check, all the things you just said also sound like Manchester United to me.
But no, but
not expected to achieve anything.
But then I was having a very interesting chat with our friend Karl Anka before the podcast started.
We like Karl Anka.
We do like Karl Anka.
And does this podcast have more than one friend?
I think apparently so.
It's a very popular podcast. Yeah. It's very popular. It's very likable. You know, like us anyway. And Carl said there's a kind of a, I'm paraphrasing, but there's a sort of a an imbalance between the recognition that Man United are not currently very good, but then this expectation that we're Man United, of course we're good.
Sure.
And there's a little bit of an issue between the sort of the relationship between those two kind of contradictory issues.
Well, let me ask you this question then, to top off that lovely little monologue that you just did there. The two names that are, you know, associate, and I promise for listeners, we will move on. I spent a long talk about Manchester United, but this is the last question.
Yeah.
The two names that are most frequently associated with the club, so far as next managers go, Pochettino is one. Mm. Ten Hag is the other. Mm-hmm. Now, based on everything we've just said, if you bring Ten Hag in, who is a coach who is I'm sure well respected, at least relatively so within the game for what he's achieved at Ajax, largely for the way that he's enabled that team to play and the distance he's taken them, but hasn't really achieved anything outside of that environment. And you put him as the coach of Manchester United and expect it to be different from any previous year. Yeah. Reflection on how much quality Ten Hag has as a manager.
Yeah.
But does that really sound like something that's going to work?
Nope. And I think Pochettino would be the safer bet of the two, and that's purely because he now has the track record of dealing with huge egos, generation-defining egos at Paris Saint-Germain. But Erik ten Hag, the thing is about Man United, it does not matter how good your ideas about the game are if you can't communicate or if you can't get the players to listen to you. And if you're a surly Manchester United fan who has taken 3-4 years of public criticism, who's been scapegoated, all that stuff, and Erik ten Hag walks in with his Eredivisie titles and his belief in how the game should be played,
and says, now we're going to do it this way.
People like me, people like you, we would think, this is really interesting. This could add up to something. This is in your best interest. A lot of players don't give a shit. That's how it seems from the outside, at least. It's players who they believe themselves above philosophy sometimes. And that seems to be particularly true.
I don't think that's wrong. That's kind of what I was saying before. If you are Cristiano Ronaldo, for example, or if you are a player at Manchester United that's achieved an awful lot over your career, and someone comes from Ajax who, sure, is a good coach, a good tactician, whatever, hasn't won the Champions League, hasn't managed in the Premier League before. I know I'm starting to sound like I'm on, a different type of radio show. But genuinely, if you are a player in that situation, why shouldn't you think, well, hold on, I deserve the absolute best. I deserve someone who has all the experience in the world. I would respect someone in that situation because of what I've been through as a player. Surely that's expected.
There's two separate questions there, though. Mm-hmm. Like, ultimately, Ronaldo, for example, and we're not picking him out for any particular reason, but he's still an employee of the club.
Sure.
So if I work at a company and the board of that company decides to employ a CEO who I don't really like, I'm still drawing a wage. Like, I'm still supposed to get on with my job and do my job well.
But let's say you're not as ambitious as a Premier League footballer.
Well, that's obviously true, isn't it?
So you're Alex Stewart is at the top of his game, sure, but your game isn't as important as the Premier League footballer's game. Your career could continue, well into your 120s. I know you're a wealthy man. I'm sure you've got some cryogenic technology at home in your father's basement. Mm. But these players have a short window to achieve what they want.
I agree.
They deserve better than you.
I think Manchester United definitely deserve better than me in all kinds of ways. I have no issue with players expressing an opinion.
Yeah.
And indeed, there have been successful dressing rooms like Ajax in the 1970s where players were able to do that. Mm. But at the same time, there is a big difference between somebody going, have we considered this tactical approach? And someone who does come across as a little bit entitled, marching into the office and going, well, if you're not going to play me this way, I'm not saying that Ronaldo has done that.
No, but sure.
There is clearly a line between being a participant in a tactical evolution and being a prima donna.
And also being someone who is easy to get the best out of. Because even if you're not consciously deciding to not play for the manager or whatever the general accusation is, I think it's much more likely that it's a situation in which you don't feel your best.
Yeah.
You're not feeling utilized as well. Yeah. It stops you being able to play your best game.
In Football Manager, if you set your tactics up and you want everyone to press incredibly hard, there's always going to be a player that goes, pressing very much, because, and that may be for very sensible reasons, like they need to conserve their energy for certain natural types fitness, of runs, natural six. Fitness, right, yeah, whatever yeah. it is. I think the problem again with United is that the dressing room has some players, I'm going to say people like Sancho or Rashford, who are likely to embrace new ideas and try different things. And then you have certain other players who are maybe more inclined to take their own view of things. Mm. And then you have some players who would like to take their own view, but maybe aren't actually good enough to be able to do that.
That's the thing. Because for me, when you look at Man United, there's a lot of players who behave as if they are among the very best players in the world. Mm-hmm. There aren't many players in that category at Man United at the moment.
Sure.
Really. I mean,
there aren't
Ronaldo
any.
Was. Sancho could be, Pogba could be, Fernandes maybe on a very good day. I don't think Fernandes is, if you're picking a World 11, Fernandes doesn't get into it.
No, sure.
Good player, don't get me wrong. But so you can strut a little bit when you've won five European Cups and, you know, Ronaldo has that, but but it's, you can't behave like a star and have all the entitlement and the trappings of stardom until you've actually done it. And so United are... probably a lot of United players are a stage before they're entitled to behave in the way you're describing.
And actually, it's interesting that you bring up Pogba, because Pogba for me is one of the players who has actually really tried hard, having over the Solskjaer and Rangnick periods been moved into different positions and asked to do different roles. And it doesn't always work and it doesn't always come off. But I never look at him when he's playing and think, oh, that's someone who's coasting and doesn't care. Like, he is showing a willingness to do that stuff, despite the criticism that he gets for being a
bring
down.
Some of the criticism he deserves, but I think we're in this very strange world with Paul Pogba where the argument has gone on for so long that you only actually hear the kind of the extremities of the discussion, and both sides are wrong. Most people, I think, concede really talented player, could be fantastic, sometimes is, sometimes isn't. Responsible for some of his failings, a kind of innocent victim of the ones around him sometimes. It's just a muddle of a situation which has been reduced to a kind of a binary analysis. But he's by no means the sort of the bottom of the pile at Man United at the moment, by no means.
Well, quick question about Manchester City.
Are they good? Yes.
Are they good?
They are good.
It seemed that Gary Neville very much expected Raheem Sterling to start the game, Alex. But Jack Grealish did, which was a surprise to Gary Neville. I don't know if it was a surprise to other people, because I didn't hear anyone else talk about it.
Yeah.
Partly because I wasn't looking for anyone else who was talking about it. But I assume because Gary Neville is a sort of a, you know, an astute pundit, that was a surprise. And I'd love to know why.
I don't know why it was a surprise.
Well, why would you play Raheem Sterling instead of Jack Grealish, or vice versa, against Manchester United, I suppose, is my question.
I mean, Sterling's good at exploiting space in behind. And
in the box as well. Like, Sterling's movement in the box is... well, they're very different players. Like, Grealish is going to... Grealish is an external player. He plays from that kind of that point from the left-hand side of the penalty box. Sterling is your guy. He's going to get to a back post. He's going to get to a penalty spot. He's going to be the exclamation mark on the end of a move.
So why choose Grealish then?
I don't know.
To draw Wan-Bissaka maybe, out of possession. I mean, they seem to sort of right-hand side.
They were very heavy down the left, weren't they? All the players got dragged across there. Yeah. And I mean, both those first goals came from a congested left channel.
It seems like a very deliberate ploy. And of course, the thing with Grealish and Sterling, right, you've got Grealish as a player that attracts other players, attracts the opposition, sucks them towards him and creates space elsewhere.
A Sterling, big celestial body.
Yes, kind of. Yeah. And Sterling is a player who exploits the space that others create for him. But if you're looking...
an asteroid.
To exploit the space elsewhere with players that are running late and arriving. I thought it was also clever the way that by dragging all of the play over to City's left-hand side, you exposed Telles's deficiencies as a one-on-one defender on City's right-hand side. Yeah. That was very smart too. So like, it made a lot of sense. City would still have won the game if they played Sterling instead of Grealish.
Sure.
I wonder with Grealish whether it's partly because Grealish doesn't actually engage defenders very often, not in the way that Sterling does. So when he was coming through as a young player, I think a lot of people thought of him as like, oh, he's going to beat three or four players, defenders in one move. He doesn't really do that. He's more of a passer and a distributor. And so if you're a right back, if you're Aaron Wan-Bissaka, I think you're faced with a different conundrum. Like, Sterling is probably going to create many more one-on-one moments, which you're going to have to defend.
And Wan-Bissaka's done well against those,
typically in the past.
Sterling, I think so.
Maybe he wouldn't have done yesterday, like Alex says. I think City won't win anyway. With Grealish, I think you're attracted to the ball a little bit more. The movement comes from the defender rather than from the forward. And I wonder whether inverting that dynamic is a little bit more of a problem for Man United. Maybe we were kind of overanalyzing. I'm not sure.
Grealish is a bit similar to Luis Diaz in that way, in that because you know that he's really good at dribbling and you know that he can draw fouls,
he doesn't need to do it.
You're in two minds, and that also gives him the ability to then make clever little progressive passes, which Diaz does too.
I've noticed this in Rocket League.
If
I'm facing a player with good ball control, a player who can keep the ball close and can and turn with it quickly, or can, worst case scenario, flick it over me, in some cases, I'm less likely to challenge the player.
Yeah, for sure.
Because I'm worried about how they're going to easily get past me. Sometimes those players are not always the best at trying to get past me if I'm more of a conservative defender.
Yeah, you know? But the problem is that, and you have this for the first goal, is that you've got to stick or twist,
yeah.
Right? You either have to close them down and get your body shape
you've
right
got to
force
do one
them
or
out,
absolutely.
Or you've got to retreat back and create this little carapace around the goal because you know that De Gea is not going to be progressive. You know that Maguire's a bit flat-footed.
Sure.
So then you retreat and protect the space and wait for your right midfielder to come back and do that work, which, fair play, Elanga did his best to help out there.
Yeah.
Wan-Bissaka doesn't do either of those things. No. He stands in the middle of those two options looking confused.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there we go. Let's have a break now, because that was a long one. Yes, what a lovely break it was. Now, Watford 2-3 Arsenal. Seb, you've written here, lovely game from Ødegaard. Saka also played very well, but Arsenal still let a shaky-looking Watford team get a sniff.
Yeah, I mean, actually, I didn't write that, but I do agree with it.
Oh, who wrote that?
I wrote that.
Did you?
I sometimes contribute.
You wrote the line, let a shaky-looking Watford team get a sniff.
Yes, I did.
That's very Bloor. Stafford Bloor.
Well, it's very right, because I think we
No. Hold on.
Okay.
I'll be asking Alex now if he wrote
that.
Okay. How dare you? Alex, they got a sniff there, did they? It's a little snifter.
I think the overriding narrative here with Arsenal is that they are improving significantly and that at times the build-up play, particularly between Ødegaard and Saka, but also with Martinelli making these aggressive runs, Lacazette acting as the focal point, neat little back heels, creating space for other players, was like beautiful to watch.
The nice boys.
The nice boys. And then, you know, if you add Smith Rowe when he comes back in after, I believe, a COVID thingy, you know, there's a lot to be really pleased about if you're an Arsenal fan going forwards, but defensively, it was still way too easy for Watford to create overlaps on the left-hand side of Arsenal's defense. Tierney looks like he needs a bit of a shake or something because it's not quite happening for him. Before, Arsenal would aggressively defend the left-hand side by aggressively attacking through it. And now that a lot of the switch of players occurred on the right-hand side, because Ødegaard drifts naturally into the right half space and Saka then comes across him and in, it means that the focus there is more on how Arsenal attack down the right. The left is more of a defensive area. And when you've got Tierney and Xhaka in front of him, that does leave that flank slightly exposed, although Martinelli works really hard pressing off the ball. So I just think my final line with this was that they're very pretty at times, but never quite ugly enough. And I think that's the thing.
I think that's a hallmark of a team that haven't quite got used to winning yet.
Yeah.
So I agree. Arsenal played some really good football. It just seems as if their game management is still a work in progress. The midfield is a problem. Tierney, I think, will rebound to become I think he's a perfectly good sort of 7.5, 8 out of 10 fullback in Premier League terms. Midfield needs upgrading. Partey, fine. I know we pick on Xhaka, but it's for a reason. He's not really, Arsenal, for as long as I can remember, have looked really vulnerable in transition. And that's a problem which transcends any improvement that's been made under Arteta. And so what you have is, what you had on Sunday was an inability to control a Watford team who, I don't know, are they overwhelmingly strong in midfield or in attack? They've got nice players here and there, and Moussa Sissoko can be dynamic. But
yeah, this is the problem.
It's not,
Watford have a good front three.
Yeah.
Well, not a good front three. They have a decent front three who are tricky and have nice movement.
I like Dennis. I like Kucho.
Yeah.
I think they're pretty good players.
So you just stop the ball getting to them and it's fine and it's easy. And Watford don't have the kind of midfield that are going to aggressively combat that, but somehow Arsenal, and this is partly a function of playing a 4-2-3-1. You know, if you do have that first four bypassed, and that's why so much of the pressing burden is on Lacazette and Martinelli and Ødegaard to try and stop that happening. And I understand a lot of this, but I just think,
I think Lacazette's playing some really good football.
Lacazette's doing very well. He's not scoring, but that's not his function in this team.
This is the thing. I wonder whether internally he's kind of accepted the fact that I don't have to provide goals. Even with Aubameyang having left, I can be a facilitator and Martinelli might well be a centre forward in the making. Maybe he evolves into a number nine at some point. Saka can score goals. We've seen that. Smith Rowe can score goals when he's available and when he's playing. This is a very interesting little group. And I suppose if you're Lacazette, it seems as if his role has been simplified. You see him a lot with his back to goal,
yeah,
which is something you never used to. And he's playing, you so often see him in that kind of area between the edge of the box and the edge of the D. Like, he's your kind of focal point, and there's a lot of action that goes around him. He's the sun in the Arsenal orbit.
He also does a lot of midfield third pressing. Like, he works really, really hard. And I think when you've got a young three behind, whoever that three is, with Odegaard and Saka and Martinelli or Smith Rowe or whatever, having somebody who's going to put in the effort and be a bit of leadership at that end of the pitch. I also, in terms of them getting uglier, in a nice way, I don't mean this in any kind of judgment, but I think Ramsdale is super important for that, because Ramsdale has a bit of bastard about him. He time wastes. He gets aggressive about things.
I think sometimes he goes a little bit too far with that stuff. Like, I think Arsenal need it.
And but he's still very young.
Yeah, I think there's a danger every now and again where you see him leaning into that personality, which people like us have helped create. I understand that, but there's a little bit. You need to be solid. You need to shatter your defenders. You need to bring that personality that Arsenal have lacked in that area. But sometimes the playing about with the crowd, something like that. Next time he makes a mistake, that stuff's going to get reframed. And he's a really good goalkeeper, and he's played very well. He's made Arsenal better. All of this stuff. I suppose it might be a maturity thing. That Nias just needs to settle down a little bit, I think.
But there's some canniness there, which I think they were definitely lacking.
I think the only thing I fear with Arsenal is that the ownership or the people who control the budget look at this team and think, oh, it's going to be great. And it might well be, but it still needs investment in certain areas. This is not the point at which you say, right, well, we spent £50 million on Benjamin White, we spent money on Partey, Martinelli's coming through, we've got rid of Aubameyang from the wage bill, we're done now, just sit back and watch it evolve. No, because
What do they need?
I'm not sold on the centre-backs. I'm definitely not sold on defensive midfield. I like Gabriel. I like Benjamin White. He prefers Benjamin, apparently.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, apparently. So, learned that this weekend. I think they could do with another option there. I think let's say, for instance, I know it's a non-issue now, but say they had beaten Newcastle to Gomes in January, and you were lining him up alongside Partey, you think, that midfield is finished now.
Gimenez.
Yeah.
Sure.
But yeah, why did you wink when you pronounced it, though?
I was winking at your inability to. I mean, I still said it a bit wrong, but I said it closer.
But you said it more with a flourish. But my point is that...
call it a flourish. It's just a different
There are upgrades available in the...
I don't know why you need to be so cruel about people that live overseas and have...
You need to accept what this team's flaws are. You can't be seduced by good performances against Watford, and you need to recognize. You need to help that, allow that to build momentum. Fair enough, because it should do. Yeah. But you still need to recognize that they'll finish fourth, I think, probably. But to go to compete for sort of third, second, first, it's going to need a new midfielder.
No, but you know, 3-4 years down the line, what I want to hear,
yeah,
is that Arsenal, this team of young, friendly chaps, going to turn into, ruthless.
Yeah, but you've also got to be careful because...
cutting edge players.
It's very nice to see players like Smith Rowe and Saka evolve. And I think Saka in particular has developed into a player that I never thought he would become. He looks terrific. But if Arsenal don't keep pace with his development, you know what happens. This is what happens in English football. You get Man City, Man United. Yeah, I mean, maybe not so much Saka because he seems tied to the club, seems to have an affection for it.
Well, I think all of those young players can see some things happening at the team, right?
This is the thing. And as long as those things are happening, then those players remain happy.
Yeah.
If you get to...
All I'm looking for from you is hypothetically, if the right moves were to be made, if a little bit of investment was to be made in the team, if those players were kept happy and kept there... Are we looking at a young team that could challenge for the title in 3 years' time?
No, I don't think so. Not 3 years' time.
Four years' time.
No, because I
five
think
years
I think we're underplaying just how much investment has gone up ahead of Arsenal.
100 years' time.
Never in 100 years' time. There is no football in 100 years' time. It's just Super League. And it's just one team.
It's just one team.
Just one team playing, you know, training doing by themselves. Rondo. Yeah, exactly. That's what football looks like in 100 years.
On the live stream.
I'll tell you what, the TFO podcast in 100 years is going to be rubbish. Oh, good absolutely Lord. Rubbish. Yeah. It was awful.
It would just be Alex from his cryogenic chamber.
Yeah, and it just his head.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. No, I don't think so. I think there needs to be a bit more investment, but I think they could very easily become.
I know, but I said kind of with the investment. I know it's a complete hypothetical.
Depends what you mean by challenge for the title.
Well, I mean, like, as in until March, look like they could legitimately win the title.
I think,
like, Liverpool could theoretically legitimately win the title right now. Still,
I think
that's challenging.
I think if Arsenal bought the right centre back. Or Saliba comes back and is welcomed back into the fold. They buy the right defensive midfielder and they get a really good striker to compete with Lacazette.
Who is in his 30s now.
Yeah.
So you need to do that anyway.
Then yes, I would say so.
So that's kind of, you'd say another 150 million, 200 million pounds. And then you put them in that conversation. But spending the money is one thing. Whether they have access to those players from outside that sort of Manchester City-Liverpool group. Because if you're targeting players who, like the Luis Diaz situation, you can want a player like that and you can afford him. But if Liverpool also do, or Manchester City, or probably Man United.
People just want a dream set. All we're doing here is allowing a little
dream to
slip through.
Let's just facilitate some happiness.
I prefer to think about it if I think that could, this project could become a thing. Okay. Fruition could occur.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying?
Okay.
Believe, Joe.
Believe. I believe. Again, preempting some of the comments when below this podcast episode, of course, people saying Seb Stafford-Blaw, the Tottenham fan who refuses to accept that Arsenal are good.
Oh no, Arsenal!
Seb Stafford-Blaw, the Tottenham fan who says Arsenal couldn't win even in 100 years.
Arsenal are very good. I think Arsenal are fourth best team in the country at the moment.
Better than Spurs.
Oh god, yeah. I don't think Spurs are even in the conversation for the top four.
What I forced him to do.
I think the table suggests that they might be, but then...
Through attacking his integrity. Look what he's doing now.
Yeah,
you've got less integrity than you had 30 seconds ago.
I am chiselling away my own integrity.
Now you're grovelling at the floor of the public.
I break the...
The public aren't to be listened to. People get this wrong all the time. People think the public are to be listened to. The public are to be ignored and told.
I believe in the BBC. You would make an excellent dictator.
Well, thank you.
You have that kind of slight wild-eyed...
Now stop talking.
Okay.
Next up is Leicester 1-0 Leeds, and we'll be doing that after this break. It was a great break. Leeds were better. Who wrote this one?
I did.
Okay. They were better then, were they? I mean, this was their first game under Jesse Marsh.
Yes, it was. And
the American coach...
One of the problems that RB Leipzig experienced under Jesse Marsh was they could be very vertical, but when they went forward, they had very few protections behind.
Mm-hmm.
I spoke to Yusuf Poulsen about this on The Athletic.
You spoke to Yusuf Poulsen?
Yeah.
In person?
The RB Leipzig player, I did, yes.
Over Zoom.
And he
said he was very nice.
He was very nice. He was very, very impressive, very smart guy. Might have been an accountant, by the way.
He might have been.
Yeah, I think so.
As in, like, he could have been.
Yeah, he wanted, if football didn't work out, because Yusuf Poulsen was never a blue-chip prospect, even as a teenager. He kind of ground his way into becoming a very, very good player over time, but he was thinking about a life beyond football. Yeah. Very smart. He
Don't
speaks about a dozen languages as well. He's a very smart guy. But he said that one of the problems that was solved when Domenico Tedesco arrived at Leipzig was... stability, safety when they went forward, systems, protection. And so when Marsh was appointed by Leeds, obviously having watched Bielsa's Leeds and the kind of the collapse of Bielsa's empire there, you worried whether he was really the right guy to create the balance that Leeds needed and to create the safety in their attacking play, which they haven't had for a while. But this was a step forward. It was imperfect because Leeds still gave up chances, but I felt they had the better chance at the other end of the pitch. Their movement with the ball was very, very good. Their movement of the ball was good. Their movement around it was good. And Kasper Schmeichel was comfortably the man of the match, which should tell you about the caliber of Leeds' attacking play.
Okay.
And it was a little bit of a sucker punch. And the question I'll have, and I think I put this on Twitter, was when you have a new manager and everything goes well at 0-0, what happens when you concede a goal and it feels a little bit familiar and all the novelty drains away a little bit? Leeds actually continued to play quite well. So their position remains a little bit perilous, but improved, definitely improved. And
okay.
I don't know whether, I think whether this works out depends on a couple of things. including how quickly certain players can come back from injury. Calvin Phillips has been a huge miss for Leeds United. Obviously, Patrick Bamford has too, because goals are a bit of a problem. But how is he going to be supported? Is it going to be with a kind of Leipzig-style recruitment system over the summer? Don't know, but we'll see. But I like the appointment. And okay. I think it was important that you didn't wind back everything that Bielsa had done. I don't see quite as many similarities between Marsh and Bielsa as others do, but there are some overlaps, and it means that you don't waste time basically re-educating players about how to play.
Sure.
So that's quite likeable.
Well, let's say also the most important part of this appointment, of course, is that there's a new manager with the initials JM in the Premier League now.
Ooh.
JM, of course, being Jose Mourinho.
Yeah, and this new JM has an okay run of games. Mm. So they've got Villa, Norwich, Wolves and Southampton. Villa look like they're in a good run of form. Wolves had a terrible result on Saturday. Southampton were, they're absolutely dreadful at Villa. That was bizarrely bad. And Norwich, sorry, Uncle Damien. So he might have the opportunity to pick up a few points. Can we also talk about Harvey Barnes quickly?
Yes.
Because I think Harvey Barnes should be playing for England.
Well, we've had this conversation before, so I'm going to ask Alex this. Alex, given the talent currently in the England setup in Harvey Barnes' position, do you think Harvey Barnes should be playing for England?
No.
Yeah.
But only because of the first half of that sentence.
Right, sure.
Like he's
the key
a lovely player.
Yeah,
but
he's fantastic. He's just unfortunate to be existing at a time when there are so many players.
Yeah, he should exist at another time.
He should exist at another time.
Yeah.
I would like to see him given an opportunity in the squad. I just think that I completely agree that in a kind of talent hierarchy, he's pretty low down.
He just seems like a Tottenham player.
Yeah, he's not going to play.
That's why you like him.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's probably quite fair. But at the same time, those kind of players are useful because within the confines of an international squad, you need players who understand their role and accept the fact that they're not going to be starters, which I think could be, as time goes on, I think it's going to be a potential problem with the kind of the Phil Foden, Jack Grealish, Raheem Sterling, Jadon Sancho.
I'll give you this.
Yeah.
I can see a scenario in which in Qatar or at the next Euros or maybe even in the USA in 2026, right? USA, Mexico, Canada, let's not.
All of them. North America.
I can see a scenario where Harvey Barnes, through the injury of another player, is on the bench for the first game and comes on for the last 30 minutes and absolutely destroys an opposition team and then gets those 30 minutes throughout. He could be the kind of Odonka of 2026.
Yeah, there was also Trevor Sinclair did this in 2002 when he had he made the squad and then he was omitted from it. And he went back and forward from Japan to the UK. And then when he arrived back in the UK, having been dismissed from the camp, after the squad was cut down to 23, he was told that someone had got injured. I can't remember who it was. It might have been Danny Murphy. I forget who. But he had to turn around immediately and go back 13 hours to Japan.
Immediately?
Yeah. They turned around. And then he probably gave... he was... man of the match, probably Nicky Butt in that game, but he gave a brilliant performance against Argentina in the World Cup and that 1-0 win. But anyway, so with that kind of player, what you can't do is you can't have him on the fringes and then just say, right, well, you're going to come on for 20 minutes here and, you know, be a sort of part-time England player. Mm. I think you need to involve them in the unit, and there's no harm in having that second tier because they are accepting of their situation. You
sure.
can get 30 or 40 caps out of a player like that, and important goals, he could be a, not Stuart Downing, because that's not really right, but a sort of maybe a James Milner type.
Yes, a Milner.
Milner at different times during his England career was very useful. He was just
Do
never.
You remember when it was Milner and Barry in the England setup, and you know they're either sort of great stalwarts of the game or just you know, and no offense to either player, entirely uninspiring.
Well, I think the thing if Milner existed today in his prime, I think you could get he'd be very very useful as an England player because. He was a good enough footballer to be used in lots of different ways. He's a tournament player. He's hardworking. He's honest. He's a super professional, as evidenced by how long his career has gone on for and how well respected he is by Jurgen Klopp.
Yeah.
And you could mould Harvey Barnes into something like that.
Those players are sort of underappreciated because they're not going to win the game. Harvey Barnes is maybe not that player.
But I think Harvey Barnes could win a game.
Harvey Barnes could win the game.
Yeah, Southgate's shown that he's aware of this with the persistent inclusion of Connor Cody, who... doesn't even tend to play in
good
the system
that people like him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He's there to be supportive. He's
not
a leader.
Yeah.
He is experienced.
Sure.
and he generates the right ambience within a squad. And when he comes on and plays, he doesn't mess up. So that's fine also.
Yeah. Same as your Tyrone Mings.
Bit different to Tyrone Mings.
Well, no, but I mean, a good addition to the squad, I would say. Nice to have a Tyrone Mings there.
People seem to like Tyrone Mings. You know, he's a
I like Tyrone player. Mings.
Yeah, I like Tyrone Mings.
Good football. Yeah.
Fine. Also, but left-footed centre-backs also who can pass a bit more useful.
Anyway, Liverpool 1-0 West Ham. It seemed like West Ham had enough chances in this game, Seb or Alex, whoever wrote this, to win this this game many times over.
Yeah, I wrote this, and they sure did. West Ham created lots of good chances, typically coming through the middle or in sort of counter-attacking opportunities. Fornals was put through and did the kind of the... Do you remember the Danny Welbeck finish against Bayern Munich a couple of years ago when he was through on goal and he just tried to chip Manuel Neuer?
No.
Anyway, Fornals did that and didn't work out very well.
No.
Manuel Lanzini hacked over from underneath the crossbar, should have scored. I wanted to say something actually about Mikel Antonio because he has, I looked it up, only scored twice in the whole of 2022.
It's the Tifo curse.
Maybe the Tifo curse, but he was brilliant. Yeah. It was almost, it's not a Lacazette type thing, but
sure.
It's almost his contribution because it's so broad and because Antonio does so many things so well, it... makes his literal goal scoring less important.
Can I say, whenever this happens to a player, I always think of, for me, a very clear example of a player's reputation preceding them very quickly. Wayne Rooney, coming from Everton to Manchester United, that first season at Manchester United, and of course at Everton before, outstanding player. As soon as opposition teams realised that they needed to defend him, suddenly his goal output dropped off a cliff, but his commitment to the game and his ability to participate in the game
changed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, so I was curious during this game because I wanted to see who Antonio compared with on FBref, and I looked it up. And it's an amazing array of forwards. So Morata, Moreno, as in Villarreal's Moreno, Belotti from Torino, Iñaki Williams from Athletic Club in Spain. And that's interesting because I would have thought, I think of, for instance, Gerard Moreno and Iñaki Williams is very different players and providing very different things. And Antonio, you've got this player who he's like a sort of a one man gang, isn't he? Really, they do so many different things.
I had one of those when I was a child.
We have talked before about you don't want to talk about your childhood on the podcast.
it was better. It was funnier if you just carried on.
Okay. And it's, I suppose what I'm trying to say is that maybe someone like Antonio needs the things that he provides and the positions he plays, because they're so unique, it kind of needs its own name. The same that, you know, Thomas Smith rammed out it, you know, that kind of stuff. You need you need a name for Antonio, because he's, it doesn't matter so much that he doesn't score goals, because if you look at the things that come off his, if you imagine a bowling ball skittling, opposition players and the damage that does and the space that creates, that is Antonio. He's a force.
I'd be happy to call it the Antonio role. Hands up for agreeing with me.
I quite like it. I think it needs it because he's a good enough player to warrant it. I think if he hadn't come through the Football League, if he didn't have a quite an ordinary beginning in the game and he didn't sort of grow into being the Premier League player he is, I think more of a fuss would be made about Antonio because he's so different.
Yeah.
So different. And
where's
so
my gavel? I agree.
Okay, good.
Yeah. That's, fine. Luis Diaz.
We should get a gavel for the podcast.
It would be too loud.
No, but a massive one that we
I think a rubber one that hits the table and goes.
Maybe a gong.
Gong?
You could just.
I have a gong.
You've got a gong at home.
Bring that in for
World Cup. It's in my parents' house.
Yeah.
Okay.
Every time you throw a zinger, you hit the gong too.
Or maybe we could use it.
It hasn't been hit for 15 years.
We could use it to indicate breaks.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah. You know how we usually indicate breaks?
Joe just says it.
Just says there's going to be a break. Yeah.
It's a good way of doing it, but, you know.
It's a lot easier than hitting a gong. Yeah,
Stafford Blore overcomplicates things again. Now, Luis Diaz here, you say, is worth his own conversation. And we will have that, but another time.
Yeah, okay.
Other lines. Oh, Ivan Toney scored a hat-trick for Brentford, of course.
Two
disappointing
penalties.
That it was against Norwich.
Yeah, that's Brentford's first hat-trick in the Premier League.
Yeah.
He takes penalties in a really good way.
What does he do?
He takes like one step and absolutely thwacks it across. Krull went the wrong way first time, right way second time, still didn't get close.
Right.
And the third goal, it was his first goal actually, but it was like a back post tap-in from a...
That-
Christoph Eier header on at a corner supplied by Christian Eriksen.
The thing about that goal is, for those who've seen it, Brentford are good at set pieces and they invest a lot of time in perfecting set pieces.
Yeah.
Still unforgivable defending. You cannot, if you...
Maybe the gong could be for when we say the same thing the 50th time. When you, if next time when you talk about Brentford, you reference how good they are at taking set pieces, I could hit the gong.
Oh, but this is actually going to be about how bad Norwich are at something. So it's I don't think it's gong worthy.
Yeah, Norwich are bad at defending.
So if you if
everyone knows that,
if you're defending Brentford, what are you at piece? You're thinking like, who am I looking after? You know, who's my man? Where's
what else are you thinking? You,
well, where's Ivan Toney?
Yeah,
because how can he score?
I think that all the time. Anyway.
Even when I'm not watching football, where's Ivan Toney right now? I wonder what he's doing right now.
Good flicked header, good corner from Eriksen. Why is Ivan Toney in 5 yards of space at the back post by himself?
You've talked a lot today, and I sort of just zoning out. I kind of don't care about what you're saying.
I don't know if like that goal
sometimes I see myself
it.
As a sort of a conduit for the listeners, and I wonder if they're listening to you and thinking, "I wish this guy would shut the fuck up."
That would be a good gong moment.
Yeah, gong.
Instead of that, you just hit the gong and that silences people.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I think it was Uncle Damien that said, we desperately have to win this game. And then Norwich lost. So, you know, it's a real shame. Other things, we've already mentioned Southampton being terrible. Maybe we could talk about that again another time too.
It's terrible in one game. Southampton have been very good otherwise in 2022.
I agree with you.
And
Coutinho, that's what this says though. Just they were great. Actually, it says horrendous against Villa.
Yeah, no, they were horrendous against Villa.
Sure. Good use of horrendous.
Though. Yeah, no, I think it's a useful use of...
Horrendous.
I just want to contextualise it to avoid undue negativity.
No, fine. Yeah. I agree. We want to avoid undue negativity as much as possible. And that's why we're ending the podcast. This has been the TIFO Football Podcast. Thanks very much for listening. Seb Stafford-Bloor, Dankeschön.
Dankeschön, Herr Devine.
Yes, and thank you, Alex Stewart.
Sorry, I just had an eyelash.
Sure, you had an eyelash.
In my eye.
In your eye.
Oh, that's painful.
Around the eye.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll be fine though, thank you.
Okay. Thanks as usual to producers Sol and Adonis. And we'll be back next week with another thing, which is almost exactly the same as this. And for some reason, you will download and listen to, even though you've already heard it a million times before. Thanks. Goodbye.
Athletic.